Thanks very much. And definitely, if you have ideas for talks, let me know. In fact, this talk I've constructed based on some questions people ask me about how this Scientific American thing actually works. A number of people here have had the honor of working with, here's a few of them at least, on different articles over the years. And even they are probably pretty flummoxed about how our operations work and how we choose topics and why we choose what we do and significantly how things are changing today. As you know, this is a very tumultuous time in the media industry, and we're certainly caught up in that turbulence as well. Now, I know that the main Friday afternoon event here is usually getting to those cookies at 3:15, and I assure you that I'll get you out of this room and into those cookies on time. And if you have any questions, I can definitely talk to you either here, if you still have time, there, the cookies and the coffee, or just informally. Just one-on-one. Of course, everyone here has more than an idle curiosity in knowing how a science magazine does its thing. Some people have written for it and others have read it, but everyone in the community here at least has a professional and a personal and an intellectual interest in the communication of science to the public. And I'm going to give you kind of one angle on that, and hopefully in subsequent talks I can flesh out other angles on that as well. This will be very specific to Scientific American. I think some of the lessons that we have acquired over the years are applicable to communication more generally, but I will focus on Scientific American, and hopefully we can try to abstract out from that something more broad. I don't know if you remember, probably February sometime earlier this year, there was that meme on Facebook about what does my mom think I do? It was intended to display different attitudes toward different professions and the different perspectives that people have. And here's the one that was closest to my own heart at the time, showing the different ideas that people have of astronomy of varying degrees of accuracy. This is my favorite. What we think we do and what we actually do in reducing the data that come down to us. So last night we were at the Pacaria and waiting in line, got talking about the Big Bang Theory. And then I got back to my room afterwards, and I looked for one of these for physics, and I was thinking, this has got to be something for theory. I couldn't find a single one, so I spent an hour last night coming up with one. You'll enjoy it. Ah, there. This one is straight off the CBS website from last night at 11 p.m. or whatever it was, so hot off the press.
Where's the money sink from?
Sorry?
The money sink's
for you.
The money black hole.
Oh, this, the money black hole? I can't remember where I got that one. It's confusing. It's actually hard to choose ones that captured something and were funny and really interesting as well. So, obviously the public has a variety of expectations that you have of yourselves are different from what you have of yourselves and what actually is the reality. And actually, I think the public actually kind of agrees with you on that, if that is indeed how you view yourself, I'm not sure. People have a fascination and intense interest in how everyone here does their work and the kinds of themes that you address. And it's really actually been my honor to talk with a lot of people here, and you've been so generous with your time, and I know that's the most precious resource that you have to try to understand these topics better. Now, there's a reason I will be focusing on the print magazine, the print Scientific American magazine, although, frankly, if I give this talk in a year, I may not do that. Things are changing very rapidly, and I'm spending an ever smaller fraction of my time thinking about the print magazine and more thinking about what happens online and on iPads and so forth. But I'll still talk about the print because I still think that defines what most of us think of as Scientific American. It's this, by and large, articles written by experts in their fields and published in a magazine that people can sit down and really sink their teeth into. Things have changed over the years, as we all know, but that's still kind of the core of what we do. Our editor-in-chief, Marietta Christina, who came on board, I guess, about 3 years ago, actually, she came to the magazine about 12 years ago, but ascended to that position about 2 or 3 years ago. Now actually talks about SIAM more as a platform than a magazine. There is a magazine to it, but there's a lot of other aspects. There's now a book in print, website, you name it, blog, the whole thing. And in this kind of unsettled period, there's kind of an all-of-the-above approach to how we communicate with the public. We can't be selective anymore about it. So in my comments today, I'll give you a little history of the magazine, partly because it's just fun seeing kind of these old Victorian era pictures of things, but also because there's a serious message in that. It shows how things have evolved in science communication generally over the past 180 or whatever years, 160 years. And a lot of the themes that we are faced with today actually have roots that go back even as far as 1845, which is when Scientific American started. I'll then talk a bit about how we choose topics, how we choose and shape stories, which are different from topics. I'll discuss that a little bit. Authors and illustrations, everyone's always curious about illustrations. But first, I feel I need to tell you a little bit about who I am. As I'm sure all the previous writers and journalists and artists and residents have talked about since they've started coming here, there's such a diversity of ways that people enter science communication. I think if you put two of us in a room, you'll get three different ways that we enter the profession that we're in. Some of us come from more of a science point of view, studied science, maybe got a PhD, then went into journalism. Someone started from more of a journalistic point of view and migrated into science. Maybe I have colleagues and friends who were in Fortune and NBC News and then always had an abiding love and interest in science and then migrated the other direction to somewhere in the middle. My own background is a little hybrid of really those two. More from the science point of view, I was a dual engineering and math major as an undergraduate and then studied this planet, Venus, as a graduate student in the early 1990s using data from the Magellan spacecraft. It's one of the things you can ask me about over tea time, by the way. We had those questions about what to ask at tea time. You can ask me about Venus, and I'll tell you what actually I remember of that. And I did a model. This actually isn't it, unfortunately. I didn't ever produce an animation too long ago, but a similar type of finite element code that I used in my own work. And then one of the book publications that resulted. But here's another one of the publications I worked on as well. I wrote a lot for the campus newspapers where I went to college and graduate school and local newspapers as well. So I always had this kind of left and right brain life. And then there's this new fancy thing called the World Wide Web. Thank you, Tim Berners-Lee. Thank you, CERN, for creating it because it's how I got my start in my chosen profession. Very early on, there was a job opening at Astronomical Society of the Pacific, which is a group based up in San Francisco that does science education. And I applied for it, and somewhat to my chagrin, actually got it and had to make a terrible decision a third of my way through my dissertation, what I would do with my life. My advisor was not at all pleased. So I actually did leave graduate school to do this, and I think in retrospect, it was a good decision for me, although we always have regrets in our lives, don't we? I've always liked dabbling in the big questions, the capital B, the capital Q of science. I like the variety that we science journalists have the privilege of dabbling in. And I'm still a romantic at heart. I still think science makes the world a better place. It's what really drives me in that, and it's one of the reasons I do this, is that I'm a very idealistic urge about this, and I think the public should see that as well. I will say, however, that journalism also fulfills a lot of other roles besides education. There's a critical faculty that it brings. There's entertainment. It's ultimately an entertainment business. People read because they want to. And that's something we always have to keep in the back of our minds when we do this. And also there's issues of context that we need to bring that a student, for instance, might not need. Science journalism, and I should say specifically Scientific American, it's kind of a strange hybrid, as you know if you've been reading it. It's a magazine, but it's not a magazine. It's a journal, but it's not a journal. It's somewhere in the middle. And a lot of the tension and a lot of the difficulty and fun of my job is handling that interface between the kind of the academic research worlds and the consumer commercial world that's deadline and money driven. So just to back up, let's go all the way to 1845. Scientific American was actually a newspaper founded in August of that year. It's not quite the oldest magazine in the world. I looked this up on Wikipedia, thank God for Wikipedia. The Scots magazine goes back to 17-something. Continuously published in 1739 or whatever it is. We only go back to 1845. Sorry. Obviously, the Philosophical Transactions goes back even further, but we're not counting that as a magazine per se. But again, we're almost a hybrid of that kind of thing, that's all I'll get into. Now, One of the themes is that scientific American, I'm going to bring out in history, is that scientific American is a creature of its time. And scientific American in that era was very much a creature of its time as well. It was really the chronicle of the Industrial Revolution. It was founded and run by inventors. Rufus Porter invented the revolver. It's amazing. He sold it stupidly to Samuel Colt. He should have stayed in the revolver business rather than science publishing business. But he did sell Scientific American for a pittance and then go on to other things in his life. I'm not even sure what he did then. And he sold it to two people, and if they were alive today, presumably they would have dropped out of college and founded Facebook. Ages 22 and 19, two people bought Scientific American, Orson and Alfred Beach. Orson Munn and Alfred Beach bought Scientific American and really turned it into that chronicle of the Industrial Revolution. If you go back to those early issues from 1846 onward, you see lists of inventions. In fact, Scientific American was a branch of the U.S. Patent Office. Something like a third of the patents issued in the U.S. in the 19th century, or late 19th century at least, went through Scientific American. All sorts of fun things. In fact, Beach was the inventor of the subway system in New York. His idea, something to ask me over tea time, was to use a pneumatic tube system, like the one you have in a drive-thru bank. And you actually literally propel this cylinder down the subway tunnel, and there's the beautiful Victorian picture of them doing that. Unfortunately, if you know anything about New York, when they were building what's now the NMER trains, it tore apart this whole tunnel here. And I actually went down one day to try to sneak into it in an urban exploration mode and realized the whole subway system that Beach had invented no longer exists. But anyway, it's kind of an interesting little piece of trivia across what is now City Hall in New York, first subway system. But all sorts of other inventors came through the offices of Scientific American in New York at the time. New York and New Jersey really were the Silicon Valley at their time. That's where Edison worked. Edison came by to show this newfangled phonograph that he had invented. Talking phonograph, that's the day of those wax cylinders. In fact, I've got a friend who collects these wax cylinders. They're amazing. You can hear people's voices from 1870 or 1880 when he started recording them. And then the newfangled things like Eiffel Tower. Very tall towers made of iron. It's kind of the very symbol of the Industrial Age. The Statue of Liberty. Scientific American also had a very political bent. During the American Civil War, they actually covered the American Civil War as a topic because it affected invention and affected science and technology and affected everything else in our society. So Scientific American evolved. Obviously, it's no longer a broadsheet. It turned to a magazine sometime in the early 1900s and went through various iterations. And then, just shortly after World War II, fell in very hard times and almost went bankrupt and out of business and was actually bought by the two gentlemen who created the modern Scientific American in the form we know of it today, Gerard Piel and Dennis Flanagan. Actually, I had the privilege of speaking to Dennis some years ago, shortly before he passed away. He was the one who solicited Einstein's article that we had in 1954, 1955, and hearing his stories about editing Albert Einstein were really kind of an eye-opener, something to ask me over a few times as well. The two of them prepared a set of editorials that, when I first gave a talk about Scientific American some years ago, I went back to read, and they set out the philosophy that actually defined science journalism into the modern, even to today. And that was, it's a joint effort between journalists and scientists. Those who know what they're, presumably know what you're doing, and the people who have the time to really bring it to the public. So there's kind of this marriage of the two professions that is really embodied in my own position and the others who do what I do as well. They also had an idealistic urge much like mine, a prime mover of modern history. That's what science is. Remember, this is the time when Vannevar Bush was starting NSF. This is the post-war excitement and the modern scientific establishment was created and the whole apparatus was created in this time, and Scientific American was really part of that. And that's what begins what I call, and even most of my colleagues call, that kind of golden age of the magazine. Martin Gardner, I remember, this is going back to early 70s, I don't know, I was pretty young at the time, but my dad showed me, and Scientific American used to be kind of the dad's magazine. There's always, whenever I tell people I work at Science, it's like, oh, my dad used to subscribe to it. And that was true for me as well. When he did the Game of Life, Conway's Life, on a chessboard, he took different pieces and iteration by iteration did it. And today, of course, you get how many iterations in a microsecond. And then when I was a high school and college student, there were a number of articles about computer programming. This is in the early to mid 80s, and the Mandelbrot set and other various fun things, rotating tesseracts and trying to see them from different angles. So a lot of the kind of do-it-yourself hands-on stuff came out during that era. Also the 12-page articles in gauge theories that Weinberg and Hooft did. There's also an issue that's really stuck with me my whole life. This was a special issue, 1974, on population. And it was really embodiment of the kind of instinct that Scientific American and its contributors and others have, that science isn't just the physical sciences, the biological sciences, it's also the social sciences, the political sciences. How does science affect society? And sometimes we get letters from people saying, oh, I can't believe this political article that you did. But we've always done that. It's always been a part of what Scientific American is, and I think it's an important part. I'll come back actually to that in a minute in a different context. So there was a kind of a boom period of science journalism generally in the late 70s and early to mid 80s. The Science Times and the New York Times started in, I think, 1978. Discover magazine started in 1980. There's a Omni. AAAS had its popularized version of Science 79, Science 80, Science 81. There was other things like Popular Science were renovated, Science Digest. So there was this huge outpouring. And each of these magazines had a circulation of something like 700,000. So it's a huge number of people were reading these magazines. But every success has a downside. Every cloud has a lining. And this is something that actually we deal with a lot today as well. Who advertises? Who in the right mind would advertise in a science magazine? Okay, if you're cosmetics, you advertise in Cosmo. If you want to sell telescopes, you advertise in Sky and Telescope. If you want to sell who knows what cars, Car and Driver. What do you sell in a science magazine? This was always a problem for us. And a lot of these magazines die as a result of this issue. I had to put in some special effects. Discover, of course, is still around, thank God. I think there's still things to do interesting and innovative stuff. Science Times is still around, but a lot of the science sections in newspapers, as we all know, have evaporated or been closed, largely because of this business model issue of, and there's also trends with internet today, but this is prior to that. There's no constituency for advertising in science magazines, so a lot of them just sank. Scientific American began to sink, too, in the mid-80s. Let's see, how much did it lose? I looked this up at one point. Well, it was a lot. It was losing money. Advertising pages fell 27% just in the year 1985. Circulation was dropping, too. So Scientific American was beginning to lose money. And Peel and Flanagan put the magazine up for sale. Here are among the people who, just looked this up, among the people who considered buying it, Elsevier. Let's be thankful they didn't. They charged $1,000 for the subscription. Robert Maxwell. Can you imagine? Time, Inc., Reed, The Economist Group. That probably wouldn't have been too bad, actually. But actually, it was sold in 1986 to Von Holtzbrinck, which is a German private publishing conglomerate that owns Macmillan as well. In other words, it owns Nature. We'll come back to that. So Von Holtzbrinck, Peel and Flanagan decided to sell it to Von Holtzbrinck because Von Holtzbrinck said, I promise to keep Scientific American roughly the way it was, which was an important goal for them. And by and large, Von Holtzbrinck has done that with some changes, as of course we've all seen. This is all before my time. There was a redesign that took place around the time that Von Holtzbrinck bought the magazine. And by the way, if you ever see a redesign, if you ever notice changes either in Scientific American or any publication at all, you know there's been a change of ownership. Because someone comes in and they say, everything you've done before, completely wrong, have to redo it. And then they learn that maybe it wasn't so wrong after all, but by then things changed. Scientific American went through a number of redesigns as well. I came to the magazine in 1998. This was one of my early efforts on the accelerated universe. And then there was a redesign, I guess, in early 2001 or so. This is about the third or fourth issue of it. I'm happy with this issue because the cover story, which I worked on, won a prize for the two researchers who wrote it from the solar physics division of the AAAS. But also, it was the first time we could run graphs in a magazine together. It was a 2-month period where they wouldn't let us use graphs. We had to use photos, unprinting photos. We couldn't have explanatory illustrations because the owners thought, we need to make it modern. And so they took away a lot of the topics. And then they went away. And we got sneak back to what we wanted to do. So we lay low for a few months and then went back to the, and there's plenty of graphs, by the way, in that article. So the magazine went through another redesign about a year and a half ago. And what precipitated that wasn't so much a change of ownership as Macmillan finally realizing, wait a minute, we run Nature and all the thousands of journals that Nature Publishing Group does. Why aren't we also running Scientific American? And they kind of leapt out in the corporate structure and grabbed us and put us into their own part of the company. So they erased the corporate line and drew a new one in, which had pretty momentous implications for us. It was a very traumatic year. This is all during the financial crisis in 2008. And we were physically relocated to a different office of Nature. Nature has an office in New York. That's more downtown area. We had been in Midtown Manhattan. And we're actually consolidated physically and financially and everything else with the Nature Publishing Group, although we nominally still have editorial independence.
How large is the staff?
Sorry?
How large is the staff?
I'm going to get to the largeness of the staff very soon. Thank you. So this is kind of where we stand today. There's that difficult year we had in 2008. We actually lost money, apparently. I don't really pay a lot of attention to the business side of things, but that was something I had to pay attention to. And some people were laid off. In fact, there's a whole story about how they did that. You can ask me when I'm not being recorded. So where do we stand today? Actually, I should say I gave a talk very much like this in Kansas, University of Kansas and Kansas State University 12 years ago, and I looked up some of my notes, so I'll actually be comparing then and now. This is a view graph I took from Mary P. Christina, our editor-in-chief, about our current circulation. Of just under 500,000 people in the U.S. English language edition, and then all the other language editions that we have are about another 500,000 or so. And then I think that 3.3 million readers comes from they have a factor, kind of a fudge factor. They multiply and figure every issue of the magazine is read by n number of people, something like 5 people, let's say on average, and then they figure out how many people total are reading the print magazine. So I went back to 2000 or whenever I did this before, and the circulation then was 580,000. So it's dropped. But actually, most of that drop is newsstand sales. People just don't buy magazines on newsstands as much as they used to. The newsstand sales are half of what they used to be. So it's even going down kind of just right in front of our eyes. Partly, we sold a lot at Borders bookstores, so when Borders sank, it took a lot of our issues with them as well, unfortunately. And I love Borders more than I wish Barnes & Noble had been the one to get that one. Thing. So advertising has always been just a big issue as it was back in the 80s and before. And it also is contributing, and it's all kind of tied up with the decline in newsstand and circulation. But the bottom line is driven a lot by the decline in advertising. So Scientific American, actually, I'm pleased to say, is now making money. It's making money partly because they raised the prices to libraries, but not as much as other publishing groups have done. But at least the magazine is now financially stable, which should be taken as a good thing. So who are we talking about here? Who are the readers of the magazine? And this is really, really crucial. Obviously, we're in a business, so we should know who's buying things. But just at a deeper level, whom are we writing for? It's a difficult question, actually, to answer. The data's not that great, but I'll give you what we have, and I'll give you a sense of who our model reader is. Upper 40s, median age. That has not changed since 2000, I've heard of this before. It's about 2-to-1 ratio of in gender. That has improved, if you count a balancing of that as an improvement, which I do. It used to be more like 5-to-1. Even year 2000, it was 85-15, that split. Interestingly, Discover magazine has almost 50-50 split.
And that breakdown is based on whoever the subscription is under. There's no way to correct for who else in the household might be reading.
That's a good point.
Based on your previous numbers.
I actually had a disclaimer, I'll probably should give it now, but a lot of this data is a little mushy in the sense of how is it really known. A lot of it comes from voluntary response surveys. You can't actually send a census taker out and make sure you get responses. You rely on people voluntarily responding. So there could be a bias factor in a lot of these numbers, and a lot of the things I'll show you in the next page as well. So bear that in mind. There's an uncertainty here. But it's basically people on a form filling out the M or the F. That's where that number comes from. Now, online, things are quite a bit different. I want to return kind of toward the end of the talk and talk a bit more about the dynamic of publishing in Science of America in particular on the web and in other electronic media as well. But it's actually much closer to the demographic that Discover magazine has. Younger and more balanced in terms of gender. Interestingly, there's not a lot of overlap between those two groups of readers. There are obviously some people who read the print who read online and vice versa, but not as much as you think. I don't know it quantitatively, but I'm sure that the Venn diagram don't intersect that much. So going back to those voluntary response surveys, this is the kind of breakdown of the actual people who read it, who read Scientific American. The traditional view of Scientific Americans is read by scientists probing outside their own discipline, but that's actually never been a very large fraction of the reader. People who are practicing researchers are only a small number. The most are, these are professions, mostly people in management. About half the readers have an advanced degree of some sort. So our model reader, this is the person I have in my mind as I'm editing or writing a story. It's not, obviously there's a diversity around that, fluctuations around that average, but this is what I have in my mind. Someone who studied science as an undergraduate, who was a science major, but life took them someplace else. They went to medicine, they went to teaching, bless them. They are running companies and making money for us all. Building things, people we can tax, in other words. But they always loved science. And life went on, and they had kids or settled down or whatever. And then later in life, they came back to that love. So that's the model in our minds. They know what a spectrum is. They know kind of basic terms, at least. They can dredge it up from their heads. They know what an integral is. They may not remember how to do one, but they know of it. So a lot of these terms, we don't feel we need to define that much. But they need help in understanding the concepts. And they're willing to work a little bit, probably less than they were in the 70s. I think that's one thing that's changed in our society. People just have work to do, and we all have more to do in our lives. Too many distractions. So they're less willing to work through an article maybe than they used to be. But they are willing to do a little bit of effort on it, which is good. It means they can actually learn something. So, going back to the question I had earlier, who are we? Who are the Scientific American staff? And this is a photograph taken by a colleague of mine a couple weeks ago, showing us in, or trying to show us in a panoramic view in one of our Monday staff meetings. I don't know if anyone is familiar with this person here. That's Laura Zipkovich. She's kind of Dr. Blog. He came on a couple years ago to run our blog network at the magazine. And he periodically comes up from his hovel in North Carolina to come to our meetings. And then always look in the room for the person wearing a tie. That's the person running the meeting. The rest of us are just wearing standard whatever. In fact, that's a question I asked when I interviewed at Scientific American, is what would I have to wear? I don't have to wear a suit, do I? Because that would have been a deal breaker for me. And no, they can wear just anything. Just come as you are. So we are on the editorial side, writing and editing side of the magazine, 18 people who do the writing and editing, by and large, for the magazine. And it's technically one integrated staff. We all write on all media, all platforms, but some of us write mainly on print, some like me, for instance, some work mainly on the web. It's about half and half nowadays. So since that talk I gave in 2000, we've actually lost one person on the print side and roughly doubled the web staff, which as you might imagine, something like that. We also have a number of other people, some of whom are actually in this room, who do things like copy editing, production, art. So they scurry out of the room when we get down to discussing actually what articles and things we're going to consider. So the actual core group of the magazine are these 18 people. I'm one of six senior editors. That's technically my position. The word senior just kind of put on for stroke my ego, but we are the people who look into different subject areas. Unfortunately, one of the people we lost was high energy physics. That was kind of consolidated in my position. I used to mainly just do space science, and then physics would kind of shove me into my job description as well. Not that I don't mind it, actually wanted that actively. But we had actually Grant Collins, I don't know if you recognize that name. He actually goes to string theaters, and he's now doing other projects. Unfortunately, not for us. And then Mother C. Mukherjee was the physics person before before Graham, and she was actually a nuclear physicist before coming to Scientific American. So we have a variety of talents, or still have a variety of talents on the staff. So I'm going to get into now a little bit more about how the magazine works and how we choose our topics, because I think that's really why you might be here. And along the way, I'm going to try to sprinkle in some ideas for how we envision articles and how we try to shape them, and maybe some of those ideas you can take back to your own communication projects that you do, either in the classroom or things that you write. Scientific American, as I said, occupies that kind of strange purgatory between being not quite a magazine, not quite a journal, somewhere in the middle, not quite academic, not quite commercial, somewhere in the middle, and a lot of the challenges that I have in my job, navigating that kind of interface. For instance, deadlines. We have them. Very important in commercial business to have deadlines, because ink has to go into paper and it doesn't wait. So deadlines are very important. And it comes as a shock to a lot of our authors when we get into a very deadline-driven phase of our editorial process. Academic deadlines sometimes are a little bit more flexible. I do think that there's a creative tension there, by the way. I think that this interface between those two worlds, which is something we complain about or sometimes it's difficult to navigate, is a source of actually of creativity as well, as any kind of interdisciplinary interface in any profession is. So let me talk a little bit about where we get article ideas. And let me first preface that by talking about my goals in the article ideas that I'm seeking. I'm trying broadly to track what's happening in science and what's happening in research. I want it kind of integrated over time to represent what science broadly is doing. That's my ultimate goal. Now, it's a lot of subtleties and difficulties in achieving that kind of goal. I have to know what I'm tracking. That's not easy. There's a kind of, at least for the bulk of the magazine, which are consisting of articles written by experts in their own disciplines, there's a kind of a quantum of action in that. There's one article. I can't do a 0.75 article or superposition of two articles. I have to take article by article. So sometimes that means we overcover some areas and undercover other areas. And again, I'm trying to integrate over time and roughly capture what science is doing, integrated over time. Every now and then, I feel I have to throw a wild card in to represent the diversity of science. So that, to some people, might strike them as over-covering certain topics. And this, actually, I would like to be the topic of my next talk here, is how we navigate controversies and disagreements in science. It's not an easy thing. I don't claim that we do it perfectly or even well. And I need guidance from people how precisely they're supposed to do that. But there's obviously a huge diversity of opinion on any number of topics in science. And somehow that diversity needs to be represented at some level. Some areas do get over-covered, even leaving moduloing out that whole question of this quantum issue, this quantum of article issue. Cosmology. We write a lot about it because readers want it. People love it. Quantum physics. Any kind of quantum is just like sex to our readers. It's like Cosmo putting 75 sex tips on the cover, we put quantum on our cover. Human origins. Human evolution. Utterly fascinating. And if you remember that cover I showed earlier, is about human origins. The hobbits in Indonesia, people love that. People love hearing about the latest understanding of the human evolutionary tree. It changes over time what we find that people like. Very good question. Again, it comes back to these voluntary response kinds of surveys that we do, focus groups that we do. It's imperfect. A lot of this is more of a gut instinct on our part. Life in the universe isn't as popular as it used to be. I think we Marsed people out. One too many articles on Mars. We have to do it. Obviously, a lot of important science is being done, but we don't put Mars on the cover in the way we used to. People won't respond to it, unfortunately, because I actually almost did my dissertation on Mars until the Mars Observer spacecraft was lost en route to Planet Mag to switch to Venus. So I have a personal interest in the planet Mars. Unfortunately, we can't put it on the cover anymore. Unfortunately, a number of other things also fall into the category difficult for us to do, even though it's important. Stellar astrophysics. It's hard for us to cover that. It feels old to people. They're like, didn't they solve the problem of stars back in like 1940 or something? So it's important. And sometimes I try to sneak it in. In fact, later I'm going to show an article we recently did on stellar astrophysics, and I had to sneak it in kind of a sneaky backdoor kind of way, and you'll see what we did. Chemistry. And chemists know this. This is why they call their profession nanotechnology these days. Hard for us to cover something called chemistry because people think of beakers and things. Software. We went through a period where our owners insisted we do articles on software, largely because they could sell ads against it. But how do you describe a piece of software without showing code snippets? And I mean, it's very difficult for us to do an article about software, important though it is for the modern world. Issues internal to science, funding, publishing, techniques, always of intense interest to researchers actively working, but hard for us to cover. I try to sneak them in, and again, I'll mention in a second how I try to do that. Arguably, it's the techniques in science that are more important than the actual, sometimes the discoveries. It's that will drive progress, is development of a new technique and develop a new tool, but it's hard for me to say, look at this brand new thingamabob here, because people immediately ask, well, what can I do with your thingamabob? So we have an upcoming article on the X-ray laser that Slack has now converted itself into, and it's been difficult to get a good article on that laser. So we kind of had to invert the sequence of that article to be, what are the problems it's trying to solve? And then, oh, by the way, look at this cool thing we've turned Slack into. We turned it into a free electron laser. Let's see. So how do I, at least personally, come up with these ideas? Come up with topics. Roughly half of them are coming into me, people writing in. Often people are writing in to complain. Why didn't you cover my field? You know, I immediately send back to them this great idea. How would you like to be the one to write that article? So be careful if you complain, because I'm probably going to turn to you for guidance on that. The other half come from my coming to events, such as the one I'm attending here at the Institute, by going to workshops and conferences, or trying to get out of the office and hear what people are actually doing, which is hard, because we're all so busy. Invited talks, I find, are really a good source for me in particular. For a number of reasons. Invited talks show the speaker and whether they might, I can just imagine when they give a talk, would that make a good article? Because they're kind of laying things out in their talk. Also, the fact that they were invited to give an hour-long or 45-minute-long talk indicates some level of interest among other people in that, which is important, because I need to know this is not just them talking. It's actually representing something bigger than they are. I also monitor what my journalistic colleagues are doing. People at Science News, for example. So I consider myself kind of up the food chain a little bit of journalism. I can kind of watch what the minnows are doing and then eat them. Journalists. I used to, back when we had our offices in Midtown Manhattan, print out the AstroPH, all of the abstracts, every afternoon. I would then take that pile of paper into the Starbucks and get my espresso and read that entire packet. You cannot do that anymore. It's impossible. I can't even keep up with the archive in one area, let alone HEP, pH, and all the other areas that in theory should be to be doing. So frankly, I've actually stopped reading archive, and I rely on things like the archive blog to help me with that a little bit. It's imperfect, but I need some kind of filter. So when I have a topic, I need to turn it into a story. Just because some topic is interesting doesn't mean it will be automatically something I just, interesting, let's write someone to write all about that topic and publish it. It needs to be shaped into a story. Now, the word story means different things to different people. It's obviously different to Jane Austen than it would be to Scientific American, whatever. But by and large, what I mean by story is something that you want to read. You actively want to read it, you can't put it down. It's compelling along somehow. And that can compel you for different reasons. It can compel you because it speaks to you and your own condition, in a novel, for example. But in this case, what I think makes a Scientific American story is it presents some kind of problem, paradox, tells some someone that, oh my God, how can it be that way? And then you've got them hooked, and you draw them in, and they'll read along. And sometimes that can be very small. Heidi Hamel, who studied Neptune, had a really interesting remark about this. She set up the spots they were seeing on Neptune. This is actually going back to the Voyager flyby. And Neptune didn't have any spots, and then a day later had spots. So she had this whole nice story about, whoa, look at all those spots. Where did they come from? So it's a little thing, but it was setting up a paradox or some kind of mystery that then she went on to provide some resolution of. The story should somehow resolve the problem. And sometimes, all these articles, some extent progress reports. If I waited to quantum gravity was solved, then I would have to plant a time capsule and someone a couple hundred years from now would actually dig it out and tell me what the resolution of the unification of physics is. So I can't wait, but we can take subsections of that and provide some kind of internal resolution to them. A story needn't be linear. In fact, if you read something like a New Yorker article, kind of the highest nonfiction story you can imagine, the high level of that, they're very seldom, we started A, went to B, went to C, went to D. They usually start at D, they go back to A, they go to C, they come back to B and a half. It's all around. Sometimes they actually give away the punchline, then retell it and spiral in on that. So the story shouldn't be a linear thing. It should. Maybe some of our articles, for instance, start with someone just jumping into the action. We had a recent one about hair production supernovae. So the author that imagined who's on the mountain observing something. So he just kind of jumped into it and then went back and said, by the way, we're trying to understand how stars explode. This is a key one. And it actually is one of the reasons we need to use journalists for some of our longer features in the magazine. Because in some communities, I think astrophysics is lucky in this respect. That obviously there are a lot of strong personalities and disagreements, but you don't get the kind of gut-hating, I will not even be in the same room as somebody else thing that you get in anthropology. So you'll notice that a lot of our human origin stories are written by Kate Wong, who's one of my colleagues. Because she finds that to do it fairly, she has to do it herself. So anyone who's written for Scientific American, a few people over here I notice, they'll probably remember my point asking them, make sure you discuss the entire field. You are a representative of not just yourself, but our community. Earlier I said that it's hard for us to cover tools, techniques, and this is kind of the way I sneak it in. We talk about them, but we talk about them in the context of some theme. So we want to understand how molecular bonds form and break. We'll use these new fancy new X-ray lasers to do that. We'll use frequency combs to do that kind of thing. So we bring out again some kind of problem paradox in the natural or social worlds, and then we'll bring in what kind of techniques we need to solve that. Then there's the vexing question of timeliness. Magazines in ephemeral form. It may sit on a coffee table or wherever people put it for a while, but it's all certainly off the newsstand within a month. So there always has to be the question, and even in a monthly magazine, let alone in a blog, which is off the front page in an hour, or a newspaper in a day, or something like New Scientist or Science News in a week, we have to answer the question, why is this article running now? And unfortunately, that means sometimes it's difficult for us to formulate a story about that. Here's another thing that I think is very important, and I kind of think of it as the Trojan horse of what I do. Even if nobody remembers what the string landscape is, sorry, they may not, a year after they read Dorn Raphael's article, at least I want them to have taken away something about how science works, because that will inform their own decisions as citizens. Arguably, it's the most important thing that these articles do. And finally, there's what I call the spouse test. I have to get to tell my wife, or she me, over dinner, what she has just read and why it's so interesting. I just read this cool article in Scientific American about fill in rest of sentence. And she can't come up with a pithy point that article made, then I know I'm in trouble. There has to be some way I can summarize it briefly so people know what they've gotten themselves into. We offer a few ideas about the writing process itself. And these are the things I've accumulated in experience that are often difficulties for our authors and that you may find when you do any project as well. You might think, oh, Scientific American consists of taking technical articles and dumbing them down. That's what we often describe as, we dumb something down. But half the time, we're smartening them up. Sometimes authors underestimate the sophistication of readers. That's cloaked in jargon. But if you start to strip away a lot of the jargon and put it into synonyms rather than technical terms, you find that often articles will say things or appeal to, like, well, the equations, the math tells us this. Well, readers don't really want to know that. It's nice that the models are saying something, but they want to know what the principles are. So what the underestimation that occurs often is the article fails to develop the physical, in terms of physics at least, the physical principles. What is at stake here? What aspect of the universe are we going to explain and describe? Then there's the issue of worrying a little too much about what your colleagues will say. Now, it's an understandable impulse. These are the people you face every day, and if you get something wrong in the article, they're going to let you know about it. But sometimes that leads people to be technically precise, but then leave the wrong impression about something. So yes, we put that adverb in that technically makes the sentence correct, and you can tell your colleagues, oh, it is technically correct, but then you misled a million people about what the actual science is. So it's better that it's better that your colleagues are angry at you, but there's a million people, or 3.3 million people are not. Then there's journalese. Now, we all know that jargon is both a necessary and an evil thing. It's necessary to intellectual discourse, and then you need to de-jargonize when you go to the public. The jargon isn't the issue, usually, because that's easy. Eccentricity, I can turn into shape of an orbit, or what have you. But it's when I see things like, this work will have implications for, that's when I have to head desk myself, just go bang down, because I can't just turn this will have implications for into some, there's no cognate for that, no synonym for that. I can just readily plug in. You have to unpack that. What are the implications? What will this tell us about nature or society or whatever? Then there's something called the received wisdom syndrome. And this is unavoidable to some extent, but we try to minimize it. This is the kind of feeling that scientists have a God's eye view of creation, and we will come down from the mountain with our tablets and tell you what's going on. So the example I often use, it's a little bit unfair, but I use it nonetheless just to get across the idea, is pulsars. What's a pulsar? A pulsar is a hyperdense neutron star rotating very rapidly and sending out radio pulses, et cetera, et cetera. Well, there's the God's eye view. I started with the object. I'm imagining we're in orbit around a pulsar and can see the jets coming off. It's better to say something like, well, a pulsar is an observed radio pulsation that, because it's occurring at a certain rate, seems to be coming from an object that's rotating too quickly to be an ordinary star, et cetera, et cetera. So again, it goes back to what I said earlier about how you know what you know. Sometimes you do need to define and just use terms. You can't explain how you know that term just for economy, but we try to minimize that. We don't want this to be Moses coming down from the mountain. This is a human enterprise. This is, you're taking photons or collisions in an accelerator and turning them into knowledge. Then there's metaphors that don't travel well. I'm going to pick on particle physics for a moment here. This is one that always bothers me. Spontaneous symmetry breaking. So it's neatly described in terms of a pencil on its edge or Mexican hat potential, which is great. Except people wonder, okay, so this Mexican hat and a ball rolling down it, and then they told me that there's these fields. The fields are sort of like iron filings around a magnet. So what the heck does a Mexican hat have to do with iron filings? And there's a train of thought that was lost there. And I've struggled with this a lot over the years. I don't claim to have a good solution. Chris Quigg and I worked on this a little bit, and we ended up developing this kind of diagram to try to explain, without resorting to the Mexican hat, what spontaneous symmetry breaking is. And if you guys have any ideas of working in your classrooms on that, I'm definitely looking forward to help, because this is very difficult and important. And in the next 6 months, you're going to see a lot of articles on this, so we better get these metaphors right. Another thing you think we might have a problem with is people writing 10,000 word treatises and we need to cut them down to 3,000 words. And it is a problem. But worse is someone who gives me 3,000 words because they got to 3,000 words, the little counter on Microsoft Word told them there were 3,000 words. George wanted 3,000 words and they stopped writing. Half the story left off. I tell everyone, don't even look at that word count. Give me the full story that you want to tell, and we will find a way. But it needs to be complete to me before I can make it complete for the reader. And this should linger over everyone's head all the time. Readers can stop anytime. There's dirty dishes for them to wash. There's stuff on TV. They can go surf. They're reading a magazine. They're reading about science. And they can always stop. So there needs to be some, especially the beginning of an article, when they flip the page. They just read an article on molecular biology. And they flip the page to something on gauge theory. You can't just start going straight into it. You have to kind of pull them in a little bit. Tell me a little bit why this is important. Then you can fire rockets and go for it. So I am running a little bit out of time, so I'm not going to go through this too much in depth. This is something I would have gone through a bit more if people were interested, and I can do it in a few time. There's a huge long life cycle, a huge long cycle of production of these articles. And I'll draw your attention to these loops here. As people have done this before, we'll recognize there's a lot of iteration. It's a very interactive process. I compare it to sort of peer review on steroids. Except we're not peers, but you get the kind of idea. And it's very interactive. And some people say, why aren't you a co-author on this article? Well, because we didn't do the work. We're just always behind the scenes on this. But it goes around and around. And again, the primary responsibility you have is to the reader. This, I'll send a little mention, because this is where things get tricky for most people. So imagine that we've gone through the whole writing process, an author submitted an article, we're ready, we've scheduled it for, in this case I've used the example of an April issue. Now it enters the deadline-driven editorial process. And Steve, I'm sure you remember what this kind of thing was like. Just very deadline-driven, have to return the proofs by a certain day, and we go in and we make changes directly to people's text, and that's always a shock. It's always done with review by the author, of course, but it's, again, a very iterative process, and people do wonder why we're not kind of co-authors on some of the articles we do. And then once the magazine appears and your mom gets to see it, it's not over for you yet, because then all the mail we get will come to you. I can assure you, if you do anything on the multiverse, anything about internal inflation, we have to put a crate, we used to, now we have to set up a whole new folder on the servers to handle the volume of mail. Of responses we get to some of these articles, and I try to filter them a little bit, but it's especially younger people, even if their questions are kind of crazy, I keep sending them to whoever's read the article, because you want to see how this is, how this article has been perceived. Let me talk a little bit about artwork, because this is something that really defines SIAM. This is what we call the wall. At our office. This is actually in the same room that I showed you a picture of earlier, where we print out all the articles in a given issue, put them on one wall for a number of purposes. One is to see whether we've done silly things like use the same word in headlines and titles and so forth. But then you can come in and see how the artwork is progressing and the kinds of diagrams we're trying to create, how they're coming along. So, in other words, I need to coordinate a huge number, when I do one of these articles, a huge number of people. Artists who generally are on freelance for us. They live in New Mexico or someplace nice, and they dial it into us in New York. Art director, who's kind of an editor, but for artists, who's a colleague of mine on this. There's someone who handles web animations. There's a whole bunch of people I need to get into a room and explain what that article is about. So there's a lot of behind-the-scenes gear work that goes on in any of these articles that sometimes you're not aware of. And it's a little bit sausage making, but people said they wanted to hear it. This is a form I will actually produce for those people to show, well, in this case, the article will be three spreads in the magazine, six pages, and we'll have a certain number of diagrams in roughly certain places in the article done for layout, artistic reasons. Now, this was the article I promised I'd come back to later on stellar astrophysics. And the trick we used here is we talked about it's an eschatology article. We talked about the far, far, far future of stars and what would happen to their metal content and the luminosities of those stars. And we kind of used the device of thinking about the extreme future to talk about astrophysics that's occurring today. So the art director who worked on this project, started with the Chandra image. The author, of course, had sent beautiful images that we proceeded, unfortunately, to ignore for the purpose of this article, and we decided, well, we wanted to do something about how stars evolve, different classes of stars evolve, and how long they live, because the longevity of the star is important for these eschatological arguments. M dwarfs will last trillion years or so, whereas the larger stars will explode in 5 million years or so. So she started with this and proceeded to develop something very similar to this. And I'm going to run this animation, and you'll see how many iterations these diagrams go through with my input, the author's input. We showed this to a couple of researchers in that area's input, and it went on for quite a long time. We put a loop in there to kind of life cycle of stars. We extended the time axis a little bit. You can see lots of comments are written on it. Things I've circled. We kept on going and going. And it almost felt like a trillion years went by the time we had the same thing. So there's a lot of iteration that actually most authors never even see. And thank God the reader doesn't see it. In fact, this, however, we did put on our website because some readers have expressed interest in how the Scientific American infographics, this is what we call them today, infographics, come together. Infographic meaning kind of a multi-part, all one-page illustration that has a lot of pieces to it. So in the last couple minutes here, I'd just like to describe a little bit about the challenges we face going online. As I said, if I give this talk in 5 years or even in a year, it'll be completely different. I'll have to make only slides because things are changing very rapidly in publishing. Some for the better and some for the worse. Hopefully we'll get an iPad app soon. We actually did have an iPad app. I can show you later if you're interested. I have an article in it, and I think maybe a couple other people have articles in it as well. Right now, online or digital media basically means our website. Now, this is an article I wrote after last week's conference in Caltech on N=4 supersymmetry, because Nimar Khani-Hamed called superconformal theories the emperor theory. So I kind of had to write something about that. And it was got a huge number of hits online. So this is what you'll see if you go to the website. I kind of want to show you what we will see on our site, because it's very illuminating. And bear in mind, anytime you visit a website, someone is watching you. This is the kind of tool we use to watch you. This is updated every second. If I bring it up in my browser, I can see by the second which article is being read the most, by how many people, how it's tracked over time. I pulled this up, of course, because mine was in the lead. It's very flattering. But this is actually, this bar is very interesting. This is how far people read in the article. This basically means, what these colors are, they read the whole article, which is very flattering. And very interesting, because it overturns some of the conventional wisdom. I've written blog posts on different aspects of meetings I've gone to, different aspects of physics and other disciplines, that are like 3,000 words long. They're as long as a print article. And the conventional wisdom is, well, people will never scroll past the first screen. It's not true anymore, if it ever were true. You can tell from these bars that, yes, they read all the way down to my article, end of my blog piece. So I think this is an encouraging sign. It means that people are still willing and desirous of reading long articles, substantial articles about science, even if it's on the screen. I should say that working online has both its downsides and its upsides. It's one of the great things about it is you do get some instant feedback from readers. We used to get a lot of crazy people writing in, and that's actually gone down because now we require them to register under their own name. The difficult part about it is that the time scales are much more rapid. They're much higher frequency than they were before. And I still don't know how the old Scientific American model of expert-authored pieces will translate into this new world. A lot of researchers are writing blogs. John Carroll and other people are writing blogs. So I think a lot of what Scientific American used to do may migrate into a blog format, though I'd like to still think that there's some room for more considered pieces as well. One thing we try to do that also makes it difficult is try to stay current. Like if there's a tsunami or a nuclear meltdown, clear the decks, and we do a lot of coverage on that. So again, the web tends to go for high frequency components of science, harder to do the long, the low frequency components that traditionally Scientific American has done. So bottom line is, I'm not sure how this is all going to shake out. I think it's interesting. One final thing I'll say, to be specific, is look at this little Facebook symbol here. Most of the people coming to our website do not go to scion.com and look at it. They come because their friend suggested it to them. In fact, you can see this on this graph. These are the referrals from social media sites, especially Twitter and Facebook. It's not the majority, but it's definitely the largest single source of people reading our website, or people coming because their friends told them, or there's some aggregator that told them to do that. Anyway, I hope this is enough food for thought for talking to me over cookies and coffee. I'm happy to answer any questions and engage in dialogue, and I would like, if it's okay, to give another talk in a couple weeks on questions of types of articles and topics we cover, and the kind of diversity and how we represent diversity within science. And I'll just leave you with another U.S. question. Yes. So if anyone has any questions, I have a couple minutes here, or we can just adjourn out to the cookie room and orbit it.
Have you determined whether there's any correlation between the readers that come to you through a social reference and those who read to the end of the article?
That's a good point. The data should exist. I don't personally have a way to. There's no database software I can use to pull that out. But that's a very good question, I should see. So whether the source of the referrals to the site indicate kind of how engaged people are. I'm sure actually the marketing people have done that.
So you mentioned your economic model. So I mean, how much money comes in from subscriptions or from advertisement and all this online stuff, the iPad thing? I mean, how does that work? Because in the end, I mean, you have to finance whatever you do.
Yes, I agree. I should have looked this up, and I apologize. I did not look up the fraction of our revenue that comes from advertising versus subscription versus individual subscription, library subscriptions, and so forth. Traditionally, advertising has been actually the majority of that. I'm sure it's no longer true. But a single ad placed by BMW in our pages would pay for 100,000. There's some ratio like that, 100,000 subscribers. So it's substantial. And actually, it's interesting. One thing I do now that I work at a magazine when I read other magazines is I can kind of read between the lines sometimes. And I can see that some things magazines do, some of the policies they have are done for the sake of advertisers. There's no conscious. I'm not getting someone tapping on me on the shoulder saying, hey, I think you should run an article about BMW. It's more subtle. We should have more technology articles because then we get Microsoft. It's less true than it used to be, fortunately. But unfortunately, that means there's less advertising too.
And the website?
The website, advertising is growing, but I think they said something like 10 cents on the dollar. So the money that we gain from a given amount of investment in the website returns much less in advertising. Something like 10% than it would in a print article. So the advertisers are migrating online, but they don't bring the same kind of buckets of money that they used to. I don't know. I mean, it's one of the big questions is, what will the business model be in publications? Scientific American is just one example of this. We're a little bit insulated from it, if anything, because most of our, at least a substantial enough part of our revenue comes from subscriptions, which are more stable. Advertisers kind of flit in and out the door. But what the model will be online, they still don't know. I've sometimes threw out a number of ideas which I think are great. Hey, let's do this. I wanted to do an app on fisheries to show people what kind of, this was years ago before it existed already, an app that would show you whether you should eat a certain fish based on whether they're coming from a sustainable fishery or not. And they love the idea, but they couldn't find a way to make money on it. So a lot of projects are just kind of nipped in the bud because of the lack of business model for it.
But also for advertisement, it's important who reads the articles, not necessarily the subject matter, but who is your audience, right? It sounds like you have very valuable audience because it's fairly young, it's your middle to the top earning age, and at the same time, people who earn good salary. So why is it not more attractive for advertisers?
You know, there's a question that I asked when I very first arrived at Scientific American in 1998, because I was working at the time in the San Francisco office, and one of the advertising people who was based there, and I used to go out to lunch because we were basically the only people there. And I say, well, why is it so hard? You think the advertisers would look at the demographic data and they make some kind of calculation about what's the portfolio of money that they have, where it's best spent, and there should be some rational decision. And she told me it's completely irrational. It's basically someone had cocktails with somebody and they met somebody, and it's all done through connections and kind of that thought process that you go through, and which I would go through if I were spending this money, they don't.
My wife is in marketing, and she, you know, they go through very, very minute decisions. Actually, they go through all the data, so demographics data, to very, very fine-tuning where the
audience. I wish she'd be the one to buy these ads, because...
Well, we're not the target audience for them, but some, I know that marketing works in very, very fine-tuned ways, so I'm kind of surprised that they wouldn't...
I'm surprised, too. I do know that they have kind of a broad... They can go kind of a broad view of this. They can go to the advertisers and say, you know, we bring to you this median income, this education level. So there's a bit of that in there. But my impression, and again, I'm removed from it. I don't have firsthand knowledge, is that that plays less role in the decisions than you might think. I could be wrong. Great, let's go break for cookies.